stranger in white in a car going somewhere, going far. How it must feel to go racing wherever you please, flying as free as a bird with his tail in the breeze. Even the fish in the sea must be longing to fly, catching a glimpse of a stranger in white racing by. To get you to look down and give in. Oh gods, hear my prayer. I'm here in the field with my feet on the ground and my face in the air, waiting for life to begin.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, January 15, 2017. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Michael Portantier and Genetessa Fox. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears to Talk in Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Genetessa Fox. Jenna is a theater writer and reviewer whose articles have appeared online at Time Out New York, Playbill.com, Broadway World, and NewYorkTheaterGuide.com. Good morning, Jenna.
Good morning.
Peter had to take a quick leave this weekend for a trip, and he'll be back next Sunday. But he did leave us with his trivia answer for last week and question for next week, so stay tuned for that. With us today, we have a very special guest. LaShanz is joining us by telephone from her home. LaShanz is known by Broadway fans and fans all over the world as being the Tony Award-winning actress and concert star of The Color Purple, If Then, Once in This Island, and more. And she has a show coming up called Feeling Good. And we'd like to talk with her about that. So, LaShanz, thanks for getting up on a Sunday morning and joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh, good morning. Happy Sunday.
Oh, happy, happy Sunday. Absolutely. So tell us about Feeling Good. You've been doing it for a few years. You did it down at the Kennedy Center and at Joe's Pub, and you're bringing it now, I guess, February 27th coming up. So tell us about the show.
Well, it's a work in progress. I am currently working on my memoir with Scholastic, and I'm very excited about that. And I was inspired. Feeling Good was started originally as a cabaret show that I was inspired to put together based on music to just get people feeling good. You know, I had gone through a traumatic divorce, and I wanted to do something to uplift my spirits and to get me thinking positively again about just everything, because I was in such a funk. And I started thinking about about life and the beauty of it, and about accomplishments that I've had, and just trying to look at the good. And it just started coming together in this evening of song. And then I wanted to take it further, because people would come back to me after the show and they'd say, LaShanz, that was so great. I would love to talk to you more about some of the points that you were making throughout your evening. It was so inspiring, so uplifting. So then I thought, well, let me focus it more about make it a little bit more for everyone and include themes that people are going through in their lives and everything. So it sort of morphed a bit about about being optimistic about your personal struggle if you have one. But then I just started having fun, and I stripped away all of the other how it started. I stripped away some of those themes and started thinking about the things that were going on that more specifically that got me to be where I am in my life today. And as I'm writing this memoir, it just started to inspire me to song. And so now the show has morphed to somewhat of a one-woman show, highlighting moments of my personal life and how I was able to survive and be not only survive but thrive, and communicate some of those themes, and hopefully it will inspire someone else.
Well, the show is coming up February 27th at the Highline Ballroom, and as you mentioned, you've done it a few times before. And you also are releasing an accompanying EP on Friday, the 24th, right before it. Tell us about the EP.
Well, I have an incredible music producer, record producer. His name is Michael Olatuja, and he has done a really brilliant arrangement of the original Nina Simone song, Feeling Good. And since that's the title of my show, of course, I will be doing that in concert. And then we've written an original song together, and that's going to be on the EP as well. And then I've done a couple arrangements of other songs by writers that I've worked with that are going to be on there as well. And these are just moments that, since I've done the show in other places, I've done it at Lincoln Center, Kennedy Center, and did in Seattle most recently, there are a couple songs that I do that people just love. So I put them on the EP as well, just so some people can have a little something to take with them when they leave.
Now, as you may know, there's at least two songs, two popular songs with that title. There's that one, I'm not sure if it even has lyrics, when was it, like from the 80s or 90s, the one that goes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
But then Chuck Mangione's
I think that's
good.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe it was Feel So Good. All right, so no, I'm wrong about that. But the one you're doing was recorded by Nina Simone, and it is from a Broadway show.
Yes, it is. And great. Of course you know that. I usually tell people that, and they're always like, really? We didn't know that.
That's come up a lot on our podcast because, as you probably know, until quite recently, it has still been featured on a commercial. On a TV commercial. It is from The Roar of the Grease Paint, The Smell of the Crowd originally, but it's been used for years, and I can't remember the product now. But just a few months ago, I remember Peter Felicia and I commenting on the fact that they're still using Feeling Good as a commercial, because it's a great song. It really, really is.
Yes, it is. Uplifting and has depth as well.
What other types of music can we hear in your show?
I'll be doing, I love Broadway musicals because of the storytelling element of all the music. So I'm using songs, I'm singing mostly songs that have stories to them. There are comedic moments, very comedic moments. There are very dramatic moments because I've had funny things happen in my life and some that weren't so funny. So I'm going to comment on all of those. I'm also doing, if you like a couple titles, I'm doing, Both Sides Now. That's one of the songs that I do in my concert. I do a song called If You Really Want, which is one of the songs that I'm collaborating with Raul Madone on. I am collaborating on a song with Kirsten Childs, who wrote The Bubbly Black Girl, Shakespeare Chameleon.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm working on a song with her and Michael, of course. And then I'm doing a couple jazz standards, songs that you probably will be familiar with, like Nine by Diane Reeves and what's the other one that I do that people are always, I do a couple of them, so like, just give me a second. what is the one that people love the most? That's All. I do that. It's a beautiful song. The way I do it, it's about my children. I do a Stevie Wonder tune. The song, it's not so much about the songs as it is about where they fit in the journey of my life and the story song. And it's a lot of dancing happens in my concert. And a lot of people get a little choked up at moments too. So takes you on a journey. It's taking me on one for sure.
Is there a particular song that you sing in tribute to your late husband?
Yes, there is. And there are actually two. There's a song about when I met him and what that was like for me in meeting him. And then there's a song about the day that the towers fell.
Oh, I'm sure that's a very, very powerful moment.
So did I read that you're going to take this out on the road and around the nation?
Yes, that's definitely what we're planning. We're planning a 6-city tour, and we wanted to start it here because this is my home, and these are all my friends and family live, so everyone can see it here, and hopefully a bunch of my fans will come out if they can. The venue is a lovely venue, the Highline Ballroom. I love performing here. I did a Valentine's Day show here a few years back and sold out. We did it twice. It was a fantastic evening. So I really love this venue because it's not like a typical theater environment, but it can be transformed to that environment if that's what you want. And this is since this isn't fully staged as a one-woman show yet, again, I said it's a work in progress. And I have Tamara Tooney directing me, which is fantastic. Mm. She's fantastic.
Brilliant.
Yes, she's directing. And so we want to put it in sort of a concert setting so that the audience, if they want to laugh or drink or walk around or just dance, they will be able to just engage with me and I can interact with them and not just sit and watch. You know, it's a mutual experience that we're having up there. So I want that. I wanted to put it in an environment that could support that.
What do you hope ultimately the audience takes away when they walk out of the theater or when they take the needle off of the EP?
That life goes on, and to appreciate every moment of your journey and to embrace it and just keep on living, as the old folks say. Just keep on living and enjoy it.
Well,
I feel like one of my missions in life is to help people understand that life can have moments that are really, really harmful to your spirit, can be, but that we need to learn how to just keep going forward because there's always something better. You just have to keep moving.
Kind of the same message as the color purple.
Interestingly enough, it is so. It wasn't mine, but yes, just to keep on going and enjoy what you have.
Is there any one song on the in the show that has a deeper meaning for you?
Yes, there are actually two, but the first one is You're Free. It's a song that I've written with Michael Olatuja about just that. Uh-huh. It's all about, ultimately, there really isn't any baggage. You're free. Just keep living. And it's a beautiful song. And then there's another Negro spiritual that I do entitled I Told Jesus. And it's a beautiful, moving, moving, moving song. And that probably is the most impactful for me as a performer. That's the one that I struggle getting through sometimes. But I love the moment. So, yep, those are the two. And You Are Free will be on the EP.
Wonderful.
Oh, great. So I'm looking down the list here, and I'm going to list them out here. Dream Girls, Once on This Island, Company, Ragtime, The Color Purple, If Then. These are some major Broadway important shows, and you've been involved with all of them. So tell us how your career started from St. Augustine, Florida, and how you got to New York.
Wow. Okay. Well, my dad was in the military, in the Coast Guard, so we traveled a bunch up and down the East and West Coast. And then they separated. And at 10 years old, my mom decided we were going to move up to Connecticut and live with my uncle for a little while. And living in Connecticut really is what exposed me to Broadway because of the television commercials. I would watch fantastic Broadway television commercials. And because in Florida, you don't see television commercials about Broadway. So I was fascinated with them. Now, of course, I had been studying dance since I was 6 years old, so I'd always been a performer and singing. That had been my passion, but didn't really know that there was this place until I was 10 years old where I could go and actually really perform and make a living out of it. So my mother started taking me to see a lot of theater, and ironically enough, the first show that I saw on Broadway was Chicago, and it had Graciela Danielle in the ensemble, and course, she was the first director who directed me as a lead on Broadway. Mm. We like to talk about we were connected before we both of us even knew we were going to be together. So it was a great moment for us to find that out. So anyway, I started there, and then I ended up going to the University of the Arts in Philadelphia for theater and dance and started auditioning. And I wanted to go to the school in Philadelphia because it was so close to New York. So I would get on that New Jersey Transit and come up to this and audition on my days off and on the weekends. And fortunately enough, I was able to land a show that started as a late night sort of Tropicana Hotel performance in Atlantic City, and then it moved to Broadway, weirdly enough. But we ran for a total of 4 performances. It was fantastic. We opened on a Friday and closed on a Sunday.
What was the name of that?
Oh, the name of it, Uptown It's Hot.
Ah, yes, yes, yes.
Yes, you remember that? It was four shows.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember the title, certainly. It was like, oh, well.
That was my big Broadway debut in the ensemble, Third Girl from the Left. But I did cover the lead, so that was fun. So from there, I just I toured for a while. I just kept auditioning. And when Once on This Island came into my life, it was out of the backstage. Do you remember when we get the paper? You would go to the little newsstand and buy the paper and scan the back page for auditions. Well, that's how I found Once on This Island. And the rest is history, or her story, as we say.
Her story.
Exactly. So you bring yourself all the way through these amazing shows that each one of them, Dreamgirls, Once on This Island, Company, Ragtime, The Color Purple, If Then, they've had... All of them have had such an impact upon Broadway, and you've had a little piece of those. Do we get a little flavor of each one of those shows in your new cabaret?
I don't sing from the shows, uh-huh. But I do sing okay. songs about those shows, about the moments in my career, but not necessarily like a direct song. There will be maybe a couple of them, but not all of them.
Sure.
It's just not enough time.
Well, of course, The Color Purple has already been revived. I think I've been reading recently something about a possible revival of Once on This Island. So how do you feel about all this, LaShance?
I think it's great that they're going to revive Once on This Island. I think that that is one of the shows that should be revived. People love that show.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorites.
It's so powerful and so sweet and beautiful. It's a gem, I think.
Yes,
of,
it really
Broadway.
Is.
And I you know, little girls come up to me all the time telling me that they were T-Moon and how much they love the song and how inspirational it was, the Waiting for Life. And I just think it's so great. And I get all kinds of little girls coming up to me, little Asian girls, little white girls, little Latina girls. They all come up to me talking about how they were T-Moon in their school. So I love that it had that kind of impact. And I think it should come back. And The Color Purple, initially I was like, already? Because, you know, because when you think of a revival of a show, you know, you like to think that it's, oh, I remember when, and that would be great to have it come back. I still couldn't believe that, because I was still sort of basking in the glow of when I did it. And then it's been revived. I was like, uh-oh, okay, well, I guess that's over. But I love the production of it. I really did. But I did feel that it was a little soon. But hey.
Well, you also got your Tony Award, so it's fine.
Yeah, but it was a great production, and people need to see that story, so I'm glad they were able to bring it back.
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, LaShance, thank you so much for visiting with us on a Sunday morning. We really appreciate it. For listeners out there, LaShance will present Feeling Good at the Highline Ballroom on Monday, February 27th at 8 p.m. It's located on 431 West 16th Street, the new Highline section of Manhattan, between 9th and 10th Avenues. And for tickets, you can visit highlineballroom.com for seats. Also, please get over to www.mslashance.com. which is a gorgeous website. I was talking with LaShawn just before we started about how beautiful the website is and the photography and how inviting it is and tons of information. Plus, LaShawn, you are all over social media at LaShawn's.com, at LaShawn's on Twitter, Facebook, everywhere. So please get out there and check it out. LaShawn, have a wonderful rest of your Sunday.
Yes.
Thank you, and same to you. Great talking to you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Got my house, it still keeps the cold out. Got my chair when my body can't hold out. Got my hands doing good like they're supposed to. Showing my heart to the folks that I'm close to. Got my eyes, though they don't see it.
So this week, I went over to the Ethel Barrymore Theater, and I saw Michael and Jenna at the theater. Or actually, I didn't see Jenna. Jenna told me that she was there. So the three of us got a chance to see The Present that Peter had talked about last week. So if you want to hear Peter's take on it, get back to last week's episode. But for this week, Michael, why don't you start us off with The Present?
Sure. I would say, first of all, I wasn't in the best mood at the start of the show because it was another one of those situations where they can't seem to get people into the theater on time.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly why they do this. Only one door was open and everyone's bags had to be checked. And I got there at 10 to 7 for a 7 p.m. performance and met my friend, and we were kind of talking in front of the theater and not really noticing how long the line was. And then we noticed how long the line was and noticed that it went from the Barrymore Theater almost all the way to Broadway. And it was now 3 minutes to seven. So I said, well, let's get online. They're not going to start without us, but obviously, you know, we're not going to have a lot of downtime once we get in. So we did, and we got in, I think, at maybe 7:01, and then they waited a couple of more minutes to get everyone else in, and then the show started very quickly. So none of those people had any opportunity to, you know, go to the restroom or whatever they might do before the show. And I just, it seems to me in retrospect that I have had a similar problem at that theater, that particular theater before at the Barrymore. It's been more of a problem there than in some other places. So I don't know what's up with that. The easiest way to solve it would be to put one more person on, you know, so they could have two lines going in and two lines checking the bags and getting people in. But I guess maybe they don't want to spend the money to do that. So I actually was planning on complaining to them about it. I haven't had a chance to do that yet. Anyway, to the play. I don't know, have a lot to say because as has been discussed before, this is an adaptation by Andrew Upton of a play by Anton Chekhov that was that he wrote, apparently started writing when he was 18 years old, and it amounted to 300 pages in manuscript, and it eventually acquired the title Platonov, but I'm not sure if that was given, the title was given by Chekhov himself or by someone else. And it was not published until 1923. So it was probably, well, certainly never intended in the original form to be produced. And we have no way of knowing how much Chekhov would have revised it if, in fact, he had planned to produce it. But it never happened. There was a previous adaptation that appeared on Broadway in 1986 by Michael Frayn, and that was called Wild Honey. And I looked it up and did some reading about it, and that one was billed as a comedy. Someone else recently described it as a sex comedy. And And P.S., that must have been something to see, because the cast included Ian McKellen, Kim Cattrall, J. Smith Cameron, and Kate Burton. So I hope I get to see Wild Honey at some point. I'd like to see what Frayn did with it, because in my view, what Andrew Upton did here is just completely incomprehensible. Now, again, I have no clue what the original was like, so I can't judge it based on that. I can only judge the final product. And I have to say, I just do not understand what it's supposed to be. Is it a tragedy? Is it a drama? Is it a satire or a farce? The thing that makes most sense to me is theater of the absurd, because all of these things keep happening that to me make absolutely no sense whatsoever. So I guess you could kind of view it as theater of the absurd and maybe find it satisfying on that level, except that I don't think you can even really do that, because there are many moments where the tone keeps shifting to one of the other styles that I once mentioned. So I just don't get it. One example I'm going to give, this might be considered a spoiler. So if people want to stop listening, but what happens towards the end of the first half, the play is in four acts, and it's the full running time is almost 3 hours. And this production is done with Act 1 and 2 together. Then there's a 15-minute intermission, then Acts 3 and 4. And by the way, Acts 3 and 4 together are much shorter than Acts 1 and 2. Acts 1 and 2 together in this production are about an hour and 48 minutes, which is just about the limit for no intermission as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, what happens at the end of towards the end of the first half is that the character played by Kate Blanchett, Anna, she is hosting people at her home for her birthday, her 40th birthday. And one of the items she receives is a pistol as a gift. So first of all, you're like, well, all right, what are we to make of that? But aside from that, then all of the guests, she and all of the guests are having dinner, I guess, not in the main house, but in it's supposed to be like a gazebo, I guess, or a sort of a side house on the property. And she suddenly announces that the whole place is wired with explosives, and that she has the detonator and she's going to blow up the house and everyone in it. So then what happens is that she does in fact blow up the house, but people get an opportunity to escape before she does that. And so therefore she does not kill everyone, including herself, which had been her plan. After this happens, for some reason, people stick around for the rest of the weekend. So I don't know exactly what is supposed to be happening. Oh, and then plus at the end of the play, in addition to all of this nonsense, there's a lot of romantic intrigue and, just conflicts happening between the various characters. And it comes to a head towards the end of the play with especially this one married couple, where the female of the couple is contemplating running away with Platonov, Mikhail Platonov. And her husband is very, very upset. And so they're having words, and then he and Platonov are having words, and there's all this conflict in the air. And Kate Blanchett's character, Anna, turns to them and says, "Why are people so mean? Why can't people just be nice to each other?" And this is the woman who tried to kill them all. So I guess I am not equipped to evaluate this play, because I really don't understand what it's trying to be. But to me, it didn't make any sense whatsoever. And so all of the excellent acting by Kate Blanchett and Richard Roxburgh and the rest of the cast from Australia — this is a completely Australian cast and an Australian production — none of I can enjoy the acting in itself, but I was so confused and weirded out by what was happening that I really did not have a positive reaction to the play overall. I should mention the couple seated next to me left an intermission. I didn't notice huge amounts of walkouts, but they did. And there were a couple of other empty seats around me. So that, I'm not sure that other people know what to make of it either.
So, Michael, before the show started, yes, the house was packed and we were packed in like sardines. And after an intermission, I noticed too a little bit of breathing room, which was nice. But you've never gone out to Fire Island to a summer house where the host tried to kill you and you were like, should I stay? It's a really nice house. And, you know, it's a long
weekend.
How often
do I get to the beach? And, it probably won't happen again, you know.
Probably won't happen again. So, yeah, I see what you're saying there. I think I guess it all depends upon the situation.
Well, again, not having seen Wild Honey, I could only imagine that the only way that would work is if it was all played as over-the-top comedy. And completely unrealistic. So I really do want to see that play. Or maybe if I don't have an opportunity to do that, maybe I'll at least get a hold of the script, because I'd really love to see what Michael Frayn did with it.
Yeah, and then they talk, about the phrase used, Chekhov's gun, when, right. if there's a gun in the scene, it's going to be used. let's not waste not want not. So,
before she blows up the house, she shoots off the gun twice in the living room of the main house. And that doesn't get people to leave either. So,
yeah. One of my favorite parts of the evening was somebody else shot a gun and then looked at her and apologized for shooting. Sorry about the ceiling. All right. So, Jenna, what is your take on this production?
I certainly agree with Michael that the cast was top-notch. They did wonderful work. Cate Blanchett, obviously, 2-time Oscar winner. She's a very talented actress. Richard Roxburgh more than holds his own with her. They did lovely work, but I also agree that the script made no sense. It felt bloated and uneven. It really felt like an 18-year-old's first attempt at writing something. And like an 18-year-old, at one minute, you're hyperactive and optimistic about everything, and everything is hilarious. And then at the next minute, everything is miserable. It just was so wildly uneven. And for 3 hours of this intensely bipolar story of just jumping from one emotion to the next with no real reason. I don't know the original script, the long play without a title, as it apparently was called. And, they really could have gone with that as the title of the piece. A long play without a title. Upton's adaptation, I have no idea how faithful it is. To the original. I need to see this script and compare it to whatever was found in that trunk. But it feels like an 18-year-old's first draft. I mean, no offense to Mr. Upton, but it really was an uneven storytelling. I did appreciate, like, as you said, Chekhov's gun. And you can tell where he got that cliche from, because the guns are in every moment. And I think used amusingly. But I did enjoy seeing elements of later Chekhov plays coming into play, like the seagull. Everyone loves somebody who doesn't love them back, and everyone is miserable in love, and all romance is unrequited. And it's an early version of what he later polished up beautifully into his masterpieces. It's like it's like looking at the finished Seurat, Sunday afternoon on the island of La Grande Jatte, and then looking at the studies that are also reproduced widely and seeing how you get from one to the other. This could be said to, an early study of a Chekhov play. And it's interesting in that respect, but knowing that it's also an adaptation, it sort of takes away from, this is what the teenage Anton was trying to write. We sort of lose that by having this be an adaptation of an unfinished play.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I did feel that there were moments. And again, I have no idea what exactly was retained from Chekhov and what wasn't. But there were right. moments when I thought, oh, yeah, this is a hint of what Chekhov was going to become. There are some really wonderful conversations like between two characters at a time. Some of the philosophical conversations are also very interesting and profound and beautiful. And you could see there are hints of the greatness. Absolutely.
Yeah. I was wanting for this production to be much better. As you both have pointed out and Peter pointed out last week, there's some amazing talent up on that stage. And some really good moments, and I wish that the moments had in between were a little bit edited. I felt like Act 1 and Act 3 went that opening scene that they call an act was much, much too long. And that scene where they kept on pumping in fog, I kept on thinking, are they going to actually... Is it going to the point where this fog is symbolizing that they're all actually dead?
I was wondering
the same thing. Yep.
Especially because they all kept coming, you know, one character would go off and another one would come on, and you were like, it seemed like the entire cast came on.
Seemed like everybody had their, you know, their scene during each one of the acts. And, and I just felt it was in severe need of a dramaturg that would, you know, make judicious cuts here and make it come in less than 3 hours. I can't imagine going to this at an 8 o'clock show.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Because, you know, even at that, we were out just after, you know, 10:10 or something like that. So it was 3 hours plus after, as Michael pointed out, that we got a late start. You know, so and interesting to me is that this is scheduled to run through March 19th. Is something coming in the Barrymore after March 19th? Does anybody know? I should take a look at that.
I can never remember those things. I'm sorry.
Let me check that Broadway Stars thing. Let me see Barrymore.
I think there must be, because supposedly
Alton Brown was November 27th. The present is right now 6 degrees of separation, April 25th.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So they can't extend for the Tonys unless they bump 6 degrees, which I can't imagine that's going to happen. So I was interested that they're not going to try to, you know, get some awards out of this. Well, maybe they will, but you know, as far as I understand, they haven't really invited Tony voters. Now that the media is not Tony voters for the most part, so you know, the Sydney Theater Company is doing something very interesting here in presenting something. You know, certainly Chekhov is someone who we you know. The theater folks need to see everything that he's ever written just to understand his body of work. And so I guess that plays in here. But again, we don't know how much Andrew Upton has changed in this script.
Right.
I thought that this was it was great to see Cate Blanchett on stage and Richard Roxburgh and the other folks that came in to do this. So
I agree, but I will be eternally grateful that I got to see her on stage in A Streetcar Named Desire at BAM with the same company. And that was that was unforgettable. So but yes, for everyone else,
that's the production they should have brought to Broadway.
Yeah. I mean, not to get into it, but it seems like she has very very strong thoughts about what she wants to do and what she doesn't want to do. And she might have what one might think of as idiosyncratic ways of thinking about those things. I don't know why she focused on this. And I'm saying she because I think it's fair to say that she's the muscle behind all of these productions because she is such a famous star and such a great actress. But this is what she chose, and who knows what she'll do next or when we'll see her back. So if you want to see her, you will not be disappointed in her performance by any means.
Absolutely. All right, let's move forward. Michael got over to the Metropolitan Opera to see a production of Romeo and Juliet?
Yes.
A new production of Romeo and Juliet directed by our good friend Bartlett Scher.
Yes, and I'm happy to say this is the best production he has directed at the Met. It's really beautiful. And it's got a team that would be very well known to theater goers. Set designed by Michael Juergen, costumes Catherine Zuber, lighting Jennifer Tipton, choreography by Chase Brock, and fight direction by B.H. Barry. And I want to say from the beginning, as great as this production was in terms of the singing, the direction, the costumes, the sets, and everything else, the first thing my friend and I said to each other at the end of the first half was, that was the best fight choreography we have ever seen, especially in an opera, but even I think on stage. There's an extended sword fight in Romeo and Juliet. Well, this is the Gounod opera, Romeo et Juliet, but there is the extended sword fight just where it occurs in the play, which results in the death of Mercutio. And it was so well done. It seemed like they had been rehearsing it for a year. I mean, and these are opera singers. They must have really, really tried to get it right, and they did. And this would be worth seeing if only for the fight choreography. So how's that for praise of B.H. Barry's work and of the incredible rehearsal that these opera singers put into it? But aside from that, it's a beautiful opera by Gounod based on Shakespeare's play. It's not the only opera based on Romeo and Juliet. There's an older opera called I Capuletti e I Montichi by Bellini that is sometimes done. But this one, I think, is much more famous. And it's a good adaptation in terms of what is kept and what is cut. It actually starts with the ball scene. The ball at which Romeo and Juliet meet. But it starts with that scene. Well, actually, it starts with the chorus coming out and delivering the equivalent of the opening lines that the chorus in the play deliver, you know, two houses divided against each other, or whatever those lines are, and giving you the background of the play. Then we go to the ball, but then we switch to the street outside because Romeo and his pals are on their way to the ball. So that's we get to see them there, and that's where Romeo sings his aria about the dream that he had. There are many moments in the opera that are almost word for word, well, French translations of lines from the play, many scenes that correspond. Mercutio's Queen Mab speech, it becomes an aria. The line, a plague on both your houses, is definitely retained. And a lot of many of the beautiful lines in the balcony scene are there too. The cast is just amazing. Vittorio Grigolo, who is a superstar tenor and deserves to be, is perfect in every possible way as Romeo. And Diana Damrau as Juliet. These are both gorgeous looking people, which really, you know, I mean, not to be superficial, but it really helps, I think, in that particular story to have two really beautiful people playing Romeo and Juliet. In addition to them, we have this excellent Canadian baritone, Elliot Madore, as Mercutio. And the nurse, for some reason, the nurse is called Gertrude in this adaptation of Romeo and Juliet. I'm like, isn't she from Hamlet? But anyway, she's called Gertrude, and believe it or not, she is played by a singer named Diana Montague, which I thought was kind of really kind of cute and sweet that somebody with that name ends up in this play about the Montagues and the Capulets. Anyway, beautiful, beautiful production. And it's a big, big hit. I think they're going to bring it back, and there are several more performances scheduled. So if you can get there at all, it's really worth it. And really, really bravo to Bart Scher for putting it all together so beautifully.
All right. So I have a link to the Metropolitan Opera's beautiful website and the Romeo and Juliet there, where they have a synopsis, and they have have you ever seen this before? The running time is broken up into when the house opens, how long the first act is, the intermission, the second act, and the end of the opera. It's all on their website. Plus, the titles are in English, German, and Spanish, and it's sung in French, and they have a synopsis. And I just love what the Metropolitan Opera is doing on their website there.
I noticed that running time thing. That is so helpful. I mean, that's really, really smart and helpful. And yes, as James alluded, there are, in case you don't know, there are translations available on the back of the seat in front of you, little screens that you press if you choose to use the translations. So in this case, I don't know the opera like the back of my hand, so I definitely use them in this case. And it's so helpful. You know, you can just look down when you feel you need to, when you feel you need to, and then you just look up when you think you've got what's going on, and you enjoy the singing and the sets and everything else. Really, really, really good setup.
I wonder if in the future, as technology progresses and we have things like Google Glass, that you'll be able to put glasses on and be looking at the stage and see the information, like subtitles projected on the Google Glass or something like that, so that you don't have to look down at the seat and you can look directly at the stage and still get what's going on.
I was just thinking that, actually. You could program it so that it would be at the top or the bottom of your frame so you could see. Yeah, that would be great.
All right. Jenna, in continuing our little opera section, you got down to 54 Below, where you saw an adaptation of Dinner at 8 in an opera presentation from Minnesota. So tell us about that.
Yes, this was a new opera commissioned by Minnesota Opera. It's part of their New Works initiatives. And they worked with, this is a new adaptation of the 1930s play by George S. Kaufman and Edna Ferber. This has music by William Bolcom and a libretto by Mark Campbell. And Campbell has worked on several other commissions for Minnesota Opera. He's done opera adaptations of The Manchurian Candidate and The Shining as well. So this is, comparatively rather traditional subject for an opera compared to some other pieces he's done. This was just a selection of a few songs from the opera, which I believe is coming up soon in Minnesota. Hopefully it will come to New York. It's interesting. The moments they decided to present are some of the more emotional pieces from the play. The play was revived about, 12 years ago in New York at the Vivian Beaumont?
Mm.
Right. And a beautiful production. And they did, there's a song called Lobster and Aspic. Yeah. There's a big, that's a big plot development in the play about getting a lobster and aspic for this dinner to be held at 8 o'clock. And so this becomes an aria as Millicent Jordan, who was sung by Mary Evelyn Hanley, talks about how excited she is to present a lobster and aspic. And the opera, like the play, takes place during the height of the Depression, and she is determined to show off how wealthy she is. So the song, or the aria, I should say, really nicely conveys, you know, the desperation of the times and how important it is to appear wealthy by serving this incredibly hard to prepare dish to these very influential people. That's very nicely done. There's a character, Larry Renault, who's a faded movie star who has not been able to make the transition to talkies. He has an aria called Back on Top, at all about how he's determined to, you know, regain his stardom. And another one with, you know, the several characters, Dan and Kitty Packard, are a wealthy couple. I remember Kitty Packard in the last revival was played, Emily Skinner played the role and was just wonderful. Mary Evelyn Hangley sang the part here, and really dynamic and great chemistry with Craig Irvin, who sang Dan Packard. They have some lovely duets together. The score is by, the music is by William Bolcom. Sounds very, I want to say Copland-esque. It's like Aaron Copland, dissonant and somewhat atonal in a lot of places. I was there with Michael Dale from Broadway World, and he said to him the song sounded lyric-driven rather than music-driven, and this might be the new thing for modern operas, that they're not so much focused on the big soaring melodies of the 100 years ago. Now they're focused on just telling the story and the music.
I would say that's generally true from the contemporary operas I've seen. And by the way, another play that William Bolcom adapted as an opera, it was A View from the Bridge, which was done at the Met.
Oh.
Yeah.
That one I didn't know about. Very nice.
Yeah, yeah.
The creators, after the presentation of the song selection, said that they were inspired by Verdi and Verdi's themes of how do grand events affect individuals. And I'm not that well versed on Verdi, but I like the idea that they were talking about how does the Depression affect all of these different people in New York society. And I thought that came across very nicely in the selections they picked. So I'm interested to see the opera if and when it comes to New York, or if and when I can get out to Minnesota.
So I'm looking at the Minnesota Opera's website, and this is going to play March 11th to March 19th. As part of their 2017 season. They have quite a season. They have Diana's Garden, The Nightingale, Dinner at 8, Cabaret, La Boheme. They have a Romeo and Juliet. They have
really?
Shows there, yeah. So maybe we'll have to make a trip out to Minnesota, when it's not quite so cold.
That would be good. Well, it looks like they're really taking some risks and trying some innovative pieces. And I had heard a while ago about the opera adaptations of The Shining and Manchurian Candidate. I didn't realize it was all part of the same program. They're doing some really interesting things with modern opera. So yes, I think it could definitely be worth a visit for opera fans, or even just for fans of new and original ideas. But this is not this. Well, the selections that they played did not sound like the classical idea of what an opera is. It's almost like, I don't want to say plays with operatic singing and music, but again, they were lyric driven and they were focused on the narrative and the storytelling rather than showing off vocal pyrotechnics, if that's the right phrase.
Yeah, I think there's much more of a feeling of sung dialogue in modern operas than in separate arias and ensembles and things of that sort.
So this could really appeal to non-traditional opera fans, to people who like plays. It feels like I keep wanting to avoid the phrase play with music, but they were, from the selections I saw, I mean, for each selection, they really had to explain what's happening in the story and who the characters are. It's not like you can take an excerpt, like, you know, Marian Anderson and all the classic singers would take arias and perform them out of context, and they still work beautifully. These songs are clearly part of a bigger story, and you need to appreciate the story to appreciate the aria. And I think that's a very interesting new take on what opera is becoming. And it's really neat that Minnesota Opera is commissioning these story-driven pieces.
I wonder if maybe they can take another look at American Psycho and see if they can make that work.
You know, might not be a bad idea. I could see that working as an opera.
All right. So next up, Michael, you got over to Jim Caruso's Cast Party, which is a Monday night standard here in New York. So tell us what's going on down there.
Almost every night, every Monday night at Birdland on 44th Street, West 44th Street. Jim Caruso does Cast Party is what it's called. And it starts about 9:30. And it's an open mic event. You show up. If you like to sing, you find Jim and you tell him what you'd like to sing and he'll put you on the list. Tip, though, avoid ballads. He doesn't like ballads because he just feels that they tend to bring the room down. So, but yeah, if you have something that's got a beat to it or, you know, more of an uptune, by all means, go and try your luck. You will you should know that you may be singing in the company of people like Marilyn May, who was there the night that I went. Natalie Douglas, the really, really great cabaret artist. And we also had Joan Crow and Jenna Esposito on the night I went. And the main reason I was there was because my friend Giuseppe Bausilio, who was in Billy Elliot as Billy Elliot and then was in Newsies and then was in Aladdin and now is in Cats and is going to soon be in Hello, Dolly, he sang a duet with his brother, Yannick Bittencourt, who is a member of the Paris Opera Ballet and who was visiting here. So that was quite something. The audience just adored them, and Jim, like, practically begged them to come back at some point. It was an amazing night, and Marilyn killed, as always. I highly recommend Cast Party. It's only a $25 cover. I forget what the minimum is for food and drink. I don't think it's very high. Of course, you can't be guaranteed that you will see someone like Marilyn May, but people like that drop in very, very frequently. And even if you don't get someone like that, the level of talent is, let's just say, much higher than one would see at a typical open mic event because of the reputation that this has established over, Jim said that they've been doing it for years now. I forget how long, but it's been quite a few years that they've been doing this. And he's really got it down. Jim Caruso, the accompanist is almost always Billy Stritch, and they have an incredible rapport because they've been friends for decades. And as I've always said, you know, you can be the most talented person in several other ways, but to be able to work a room and to be spontaneously humorous and entertaining and funny, that is a really unique talent that I think comparatively very few people have. But Jim has it in spades, and so does Billy whenever he throws in his little remarks too. So it's always incredibly delightful. I'm always so glad when I go. It can get a little late for some of us because it doesn't start till 9:30, and I think they go to 1 o'clock, but you don't, of course, have to stay till the end either. You have an opportunity every Monday, almost every Monday night to see it, and I would definitely check it out.
Yeah, Cast Party, you can see some amazing things. You can get a room full of Broadway stars, old and new, and see some very, very good things for, you know, the price of a very low price ticket. So
I should tell this amazing story. I'm sorry, because I think this is worth telling. A couple of years ago, I was there one night with Giuseppe and his mother, and Giuseppe sang a song that he had just recently learned, and he did very, very well. But he, at one point, he went up on the lyrics and then he recovered and then he sat down and he was kind of upset because he doesn't usually go up on the lyrics. But Liza Minnelli was there that night, and we had seen her when we came in. We didn't get a chance to talk with her, but Giuseppe and his mother, although they're from Switzerland and they don't know American culture like completely thoroughly, but they knew who Liza Minnelli was, and they were absolutely thrilled that she was there. And as I say, we didn't get a chance to talk with her because we came in late and she was already sitting down. But anyway, he sang and he did really well, but he flubbed that one line. And then I said, don't worry about it. You know, it happens all the time. And I said, I've got to go, but, I'll see you tomorrow. Apparently, after I left, Liza came over to the table and sat down next to them. And she took his hand and she said, You were amazing. You have a beautiful voice. And don't worry about forgetting the lyrics. I do it all the time. And that's why I use a teleprompter. So I just thought that was one of the sweetest stories I've ever heard in my life, that she came over and did that. And they were just, of course, they were thrilled, you know.
Only in New York.
Yes. Right. Yes.
So, Michael, you also wanted to talk about the movie Manchester by the Sea. So how's our connection to Broadway through that?
Well, it has a big theater connection because it's written and directed by Kenneth Lonergan. And beautifully so, I may say. This movie has gotten incredible reviews and deservedly. And it is it's a very, very sad but life-affirming and beautiful film. It also has some really wonderful moments of humor in it in places where you wouldn't expect it. But in addition to the Kenneth Lonergan connection, several of the actors would be familiar to theater audiences. We have C.J. Wilson, Gretchen Mol, Robert Sella, Michelle Williams, of course, is not primarily a theater actress, but she certainly has done a lot of theater, including Blackbird last season. Isn't that right? Matthew Broderick has a cameo in one scene. So he's great. But also, the main young star, Lucas Hedges, who plays Patrick, gives an incredible performance. I would not be surprised if he wins an Academy Award. It's a beautiful role, and he does it just magnificently. But he's going to be appearing in a play called Yen at the Lucille Lortel coming up soon, an MCC production, a play by Anna Jordan, directed by Trip Coleman. And the synopsis says, in Yen, Bobby and Hench are home alone. Days are filled by streaming porn, playing Call of Duty, and watching the world go by. Their mom rarely visits these days, and it's chaos when she does. But when animal-loving neighbor Jenny takes an interest in their dog Taliban, the boys discover a world far beyond what they know. So that sounds intriguing. And you're going to have a chance to see this really incredible up-and-coming star on stage, and I would definitely take it.
So we'll have to do some reviews of Yen, because it is playing down at MCC at the Lortel. It began just a few days ago, January 12th began.
Oh, I didn't realize it already started.
Yeah, it says performance began January 12th, but it doesn't have an end date on here.
Oh, yes, here it is, through February 19th, and the official opening is the 30th of January.
Okay, so see if Jenna and Michael and Peter can get down and see that and give us a review and tell us how that is.
Here's a quote from Bernie Telsey, co-artistic director of MCC and also famous casting director. So coming from him, this really means something. He says, those of us lucky enough to have already seen Kenneth Lonergan's new film, Manchester by the Sea, can agree that this year a star is born in the incredibly gifted Lucas Hedges. MCC has a great legacy of working early on with emerging stage artists, so we're particularly excited that Lucas will be sharing his unbelievably expressive gifts as an actor in his stage debut in Anna Jordan's beautiful new play.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, live up to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
No pressure. No pressure. Okay. Also in the news is Dick Gauthier passed away. Broadway fans know Dick as being the original Conrad Birdie in Bye Bye Birdie. So, Michael, do you have anything to say about Dick?
Well, just to say that he's so wonderful on that cast album. I don't know if any footage of him, video footage of him in the role exists. I have to check that out. But he really is great on the cast album. I kind of wish they had used him in the movie. I don't like that guy so much who does Birdie in the movie. Others of us will know Dick primarily from his role of Jaime the Robot on the 1960s TV series Get Smart with Don Adams and Barbara Feldon, which I guess was started soon after Bye Bye Birdie. Those are his two big credits, as far as I know. And Dick, he was living in Los Angeles until he died just a few days ago. And as we all know, 2016 was a really awful year in terms of the passing of really great beloved artists. And so I guess Dick is one of the first of 2017, and just hope there won't be too many more of those.
Okay, I guess that wraps it up for this week. Before we get on to Peter and the trivia, let me remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone and your Android device. iHeartRadio also plays us, as well as you can find us in the Google Play Store and anywhere else that you can listen to finer podcasts. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And contact information for Michael, for Jenna, for me, for Peter, for Matt Temenini, for anybody else who is on the Broadway Radio podcasts can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. Okay, Peter, so why don't you give us an answer for last week's trivia?
Well, the question was, what off-Broadway two-week flop of the late 60s had a galvanizing impact on a certain late 90s Oscar category? And the answer, on March 31st, 1969, Someone's Coming Hungry opened at the Pocket Theater at 103rd Avenue. It's now condominiums, of course. The play closed after only 16 performances, but it wasn't all for naught. Its leading lady, Blythe Danner, was greatly taken with its co-producer, Bruce Paltrow. And 8 months later, they married, and fewer than 3 years after that, they welcomed to the world their daughter, Gwyneth, who won the 1998 Oscar as Best Actress in Shakespeare in Love. By the way, the play version of Shakespeare in Love, which I saw last year in Stratford, is going to be done this summer at the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey. That hasn't been officially announced, but I believe it's going to happen. So if you're interested in the property, here's your chance to see it without going too far, if, of course, you're in our metropolitan area where we're recording. All right. Only Fred Aronowitz and Donald Tessioni guessed that one. And let's see how they and anybody else can do on the next one, which is, there aren't many show songs that begin with the letters QU, or at least have QU in them. And yet, each and every one of a certain composer's musicals, for which he provided a complete score, saw one of his melodies either start with QU or include the letters QU in their titles. So I'm looking for the name of the composer, the shows, and the names of the QU melodies. I imagine many people are going to want to say FU, but anyway, that's the question for this week. It's easier than it seems.
All right. So on behalf of Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Jenna Tessa Fox, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, give me one last kiss.